So good evening, or good morning. We continue in chapter 23, the double soul in man. So Sri Aurobindo, as he opened the chapter, was rehearsing for us the four statuses of the four stages of life's progression as it deliberately and increasingly unmasks the Satchit Ananda, which is hidden at the base of all things, as distributed here through the supramental creative consciousness, acting through the mind which fixes forms and stations them in the play of the universal time and space. So, we've seen that Sri Aurobindo identifies the very principles of Satchit Ananda with the manifesting planes of the universe. That from the supermind, originated mind, acting as a kind of vicegerent for it. From the conscious will, chit tapas, emerged the very principle of life which empowers the universe. Not just the prana that we know, but all motility, active, dynamic, the real energy of the cosmos. And of course, matter is the stationing of the principle of existence itself, sat. But if three of these four in that divine quaternary are represented here, then what about the principle of bliss? What about delight? And that is represented here in the cosmos by the soul, emblematic of that which tastes, descries from all the proliferating experience of the cosmos. What is the rasa? What is the sap? What is the essence? So it is this soul, this psyche, which represents here in our world the very principle of ananda. So the chapter began like this and then wound up in our last paragraph that we covered with a description of how it is that we arrive at the variety of experiences, pleasure, pain, indifference. And so I think we're ready now to take up the next paragraph in this. And he starts, "For as we now know by psychological observation and experiment that the subliminal mind receives and remembers all those touches of things which the surface mind ignores, so also we shall find that the subliminal soul responds to the rasa, or essence and experience of these things, which the surface desire soul rejects by distaste and refusal, or ignores by neutral unacceptance." So he's made, again, this distinction between the subliminal and the surface-facing aspects of our being. So just as there is a desire soul, which acts as a point of centration in the cosmos, there is a subliminal soul which lies behind. You remember this distinction that we drew to the term subliminal. Well, Sri Aurobindo is going to define it with some precision in coming sentences. So we'll wait for that. Here he's saying that the real soul behind tastes all the sap, not just some of it, not just a selection, that which we like, we attend to, that which we're indifferent to, we push to the side, and that which we dislike, we shrink back from. The real soul, the subliminal soul, embraces it all, finds what empowers its growth in all experiences. Self-knowledge, he writes, is impossible unless we go behind our surface existence, which is a mere result of selective outer experiences, an imperfect sounding board, or a hasty, incompetent, and fragmentary translation of a little out of the much that we are. Unless we go behind this and send down our plummet into the subconscient and open ourselves to the superconscient so as to know their relation to our surface being. So a plummet, by the way, is just a leaden weight. It's from an old French term. So a subconscient, a superconscient, and a surface being. For between these three things, our existence moves and finds in them its totality. This sums us up. So, in our starry heads, we exist in the superconscient. In our nether regions, we lapse into the subconscient. And here we are on the surface. Or are we only that? Because we have subliminal parts of our nature as well. He writes, the superconscient in us is one with the self and soul of the world and is not governed by any phenomenal diversity. It possesses, therefore, the truth of things and the delight of things in their plenitude. The subconscient, so-called, and let's stop and read this note right here. The real subconscious is a nether diminished consciousness close to the inconscient. The subliminal is a consciousness larger than our surface existence. But both belong to the inner realm of our being, of which our surface is unaware. So both are jumbled together in our common conception and parlance. And even, you might say, in psychological parlance, because it isn't all of modern psychology that recognizes what Schreier-Bindo calls the subliminal, that vast nature which lies behind but is not necessarily subconscient. He could not find the perfect term in English to describe that realm behind. So we have a surface mind, but we have a subliminal mind. It's behind the veil. And it's vast, it's cosmic and expanse. So too with our life energies, and so too even with our physical energy. We're not just this outer shell of a body. There is a subtle vehicle, a sukshma sharira, which interfaces with a wide, subtle physical cosmos. And when we're in commerce with these subtler realms of our being, then we are living in the subliminal. This is not the subconscious. The subconscious, he describes quite clearly, as being near to the inconscient, which is, you might say, the beginning point of the evolution as it moves out of the poise of complete involution and begins to creep towards materiality, towards manifest life, towards mind thinking in living matter, and upwards from there. So, precious distinction we have to keep with us. Let's start that sentence again. The subconscient, so-called, in that luminous head of itself, which we call the subliminal, is on the contrary not a true possessor, but an instrument of experience. It is not practically one with the soul and self of the world, but it is open to it through its world experience. So this is quite a contrast. The superconscient is one with the self and with the world by its very nature. The subconscient is an instrument of consciousness, but not itself that. It's as if we are dealing again with a pool of prakriti, with a mass of nature which is not indicative or signatory to the soul, but through which the soul works, rides in this car, gets out, closes the door, moves on to the next car. The subliminal soul is conscious inwardly of the rasa of things and has an equal delight in all contacts. It is conscious also of the values and standards of the surface desire soul and receives on its own surface corresponding touches of pleasure, pain, and indifference, but takes an equal delight in all. So this subliminal soul is the real soul behind the line, behind even the enginery of the subliminal mind, the subliminal life, and the subtle physical. It is behind even that. It drinks in the rasa, the essence, the sap of the experiences of the world, and is equal to all contacts, finds delight in what may seem overpoweringly threatening to the surface being, is not afraid. Yet, is working in solidarity with this frontal self, and so understands the values of that surface creature and responds, taking in its experience of pleasure and pain and indifference. In other words, he writes, our real soul within takes joy of all its experiences, gathers from them strength, pleasure, and knowledge, grows by them in its store and its plenty. So we have a superconscient, which is possessor of all experiences. We have a subconscient, which is the instrument, but not the possessor. And we have a subliminal soul, which is equal to all and interfaces with this outer instrument, and continues to use all of these possible experiences, everything that comes to it, as a means of elevation and of positive growth. It is this real soul in us, Sri Aurobindo writes, which compels the shrinking desire mind to bear and even to seek and find a pleasure in what is painful to it, to reject what is pleasant to it, to modify or even reverse its values, to equalize things in indifference, or to equalize them in joy, the joy of the variety of experience. Pardon me, the joy of the variety of existence. So the real soul in us emboldens the outer self to go against the grain, even if it hurts, to endure it, even if it's pleasant, to possibly reject it so that one has power over the nature and not mere acquiescence to it, and in all things to find joy. And this it does because it is impelled by the universal to develop itself by all kinds of experience so as to grow in nature. Otherwise, if we lived only by the surface desire soul, we could no more change or advance than the plant or stone in whose immobility or in whose routine of existence, because life is not superficially conscious, the secret soul of things has as yet no instrument by which it can rescue the life out of the fixed and narrow gamut into which it is born. And here he adds a sentence completely. The desire soul, left to itself, would circle in the same grooves forever. So this emboldened outer self is answering to a charge that the real soul puts upon it. But the real soul is also charged by dint of its solidarity with the universe to move forward, to grow. The universe insists and drives it towards this self-exceeding. We cannot rest content. We must always be moving forward. We may sometimes move backward in order to capture something that we lost or missed, but generally our direction is forward. So this implies a pressure from within, because we are in deep conspiracy with the divine will. And conspire means to breathe together with. In the view of old philosophies, pleasure and pain are inseparable, like intellectual truth and falsehood, and power and incapacity, and birth and death. Therefore, the only possible escape from them would be a total indifference, a blank response to the excitations of the world self. In other words, this would be the only way we could gain freedom from this duality, this constant cycling back and forth from one to the other, from that one back to the one before. And this would be indicative of solutions that all the great worlds spiritual paths have taken, from the Buddhist, the Christian, the Jain, the Advaitin. Therefore, the only possible escape would be a total indifference, as he writes. But this is an old solution to blank out the universe. But a subtler psychological knowledge, he says, shows us that this view, which is based on the surface facts of existence only, does not really exhaust the possibilities of the problem. It is possible, by bringing the real soul to the surface, to replace the egoistic standards of pleasure and pain by an equal and all-embracing personal, impersonal delight. So this suggests a fusion of the soul and the self, the personal truth of the divine active within us, and the impersonal self, which is broad spread everywhere. The lover of nature does this when he takes joy in all the things of nature universally, without admitting repulsion or fear or mere liking and disliking, perceiving beauty in that which seems to others mean and insignificant, bare and savage, terrible and repellent. The artist and the poet do it when they seek the rasa of the universal from the aesthetic emotion, or from the physical line, or from the mental form of beauty, or from the inner sense and power alike of that from which the ordinary man turns away, and of that to which he is attached by a sense of pleasure. So Sri Aurobindo clearly describes here our capacity to overcome and exceed the standards which normally govern our life. Even the exclusivity of the aesthete can be surpassed by the real artist within. The seeker of knowledge, the God-lover who finds the object of his love everywhere, the spiritual man, the intellectual, the sensuous, the aesthetic, all do this in their own fashion, and must do it if they would find embracingly the knowledge, the beauty, the joy, or the divinity which they seek. And we could list names and names and names of those who have, in fact, achieved that kind of impersonality in addressing and adjudging the nature of the universe they meet. It is only in the parts where the little ego is usually too strong for us. It is only in our emotional or physical joy and suffering, our pleasure and pain of life, before which the desire soul in us is utterly weak and cowardly, that the application of the divine principle becomes supremely difficult and seems to many impossible or even monstrous and repellent. So when our self-definition as the small is successful, it prevents the flowering in us of the great. Here, the ignorance of the ego shrinks from the principle of impersonality, which it yet applies without too much difficulty in science and art, and even in a certain kind of imperfect spiritual living, because there the rule of impersonality does not attack those desires cherished by the surface soul and those values of desire fixed by the surface mind in which our outward life is most vitally interested. In other words, our being can accept a kind of spirituality in which the things that govern our life are not threatened. You know, we'll go along quietly with it until those things are threatened to be taken away from us, and then we shall object. In the freer and higher movements, there is demanded of us only a limited and specialized equality and impersonality proper to a particular field of consciousness and activity, while the egoistic basis of our practical life remains to us. In the lower movements, the whole foundation of our life has to be changed in order to make room for impersonality, and this the desire soul finds impossible. So he describes here a kind of compromise that we can reach with parts of our nature. And it is an advance forward because at least there is imparted to us the possibility of a spiritual experience, even while we're protecting almost provincially areas of our nature which we don't want to be subjected to the principle of change. So the equality of the impersonal might be impossible for the desire soul, but the desire soul does not notice that more and more the infinite infringes upon its so-called freedom to exist. Now here, we're going to encounter a quite long paragraph which will take us through the rest of our evening together. This is completely added to the original pages of the Arya by Sri Aurobindo when he revised. He took the opportunity to give a fuller description to the nature of that secret soul in us. The true soul secret in us, subliminal, we have said, but the word is misleading, for this presence is not situated below the threshold of waking mind, which is what subliminal means, below the line of consciousness, but rather burns in the temple of the inmost heart, behind the thick screen of an ignorant mind, life, and body, not subliminal, but behind the veil. This veiled psychic entity is the flame of the Godhead always alight within us, inextinguishable even by that dense unconsciousness of any spiritual self within which obscures our outward nature. So always there is burning within us this flame born from the divine, indicative, remindful of that image from the Mundaka Upanishad, of that great central fire that throws out uncountable numbers of sparks, all of these sparks representing its centrality, its enormity, but moving individually into the process of the cosmos. So it is a psychic entity. Again, the term psyche from the Greek, meaning soul. And perhaps on another occasion, we'll talk a little bit about the development of this concept of the soul through the ages. Sri Aurobindo has a very specific and profound appreciation and rendering into terms understandable to us what this is. And these coming sentences are extraordinary for what they say and how precisely and profoundly they achieve their goal. Compare, if you will, when you have the opportunity, what others have written about the nature of the psyche, and I will leave names out of that. Go and dig, you'll see. It is a flame born out of the divine, and luminous inhabitant of the ignorance, grows in it till it is able to turn it towards the knowledge. It is the concealed witness and control, the hidden guide, the daimon of Socrates, the inner light or inner voice of the mystic. It is that which endures and is imperishable in us from birth to birth, untouched by death, decay, or corruption, an indestructible spark of the divine. So this is that which proceeds in us, this psychic entity, from birth to birth, cannot be extinguished, representing in time and space the values of Satchitananda, born from bliss. It is the principle of Ananda in us, moving steadily forward. Not the unborn self or Atman, for the self, even in presiding over the existence of the individual, is aware always of its universality and transcendence. It is yet its deputy in the forms of nature. The individual soul, Chaityapurusha, supporting mind, life, and body, standing behind the mental, the vital, the subtle physical being in us, and watching and profiting by their development and experience. Chaityapurusha means conscious person. So this is not the vast, the universal self. This is supported by that vast universal self. This is an aspect of it moving through that. But this psychic entity is capable of investing itself completely in the individuality, where the self is always aware of its universality and indeed arcing upwards into its transcendence. The psychic entity focuses on what its mission is here. It is capable, in its larger experience, to regain universality and transcendence, no question. But its business is to stand behind the developing mind, life, and body and support it and encourage their growth. So, you have the psychic entity, you have the subliminal mind, the subliminal life, the subtle physical in front of it, and then you have in front of that what we would call the ordinary personality, those parts and aspects of our being which reach out, extend into nature with senses, with mentation, etc., to gather the experience, to taste the rasa. Behind supporting all of this structure is this psychic entity, itself a representative of that cosmic and transcendent self above. So that is some of the architecture that Sri Aurobindo has presented here. Now, these other person powers in man, he writes, these beings of his being, and here he's talking about the parts just mentioned, the mental, the vital, the subtle physical, etc. These other person powers in man, these beings of his being are also veiled in their true entity, but they put forward temporary personalities which compose our outer individuality and whose combined superficial action and appearance of status we call ourselves. This inmost entity also, taking form in us as the psychic person, puts forward a psychic personality which changes, grows, develops from life to life. For this is the traveler between birth and death, and between death and birth. Our nature parts are only its manifold and changing vesture. What ho! So, this psychic entity is not simply dealing with a subliminal mind, life, and subtle physical, which throw forward aspects of themselves into the surface, but develops a psychic personality which stands between them. So the psyche, develops a personality which goes with it, developing from life to life. So another element in the overall architecture of our inner being. So the psychic personality is behind the temporary frontal personalities, and it is suggested can share in the immortality of the psychic entity, of that psyche, which is the basic reality of its soul. The psychic being, he says, can at first exercise only a concealed and partial and indirect action through the mind, the life, and the body, since it is these parts of nature that have to be developed as its instruments of self-expression, and it is long confined by their evolution. So the psychic being doesn't get to direct the affairs at first. It can lean in and cast an influence, but it takes a long development for these aspects of our nature to hear and respond clearly and decisively to the call of the soul from behind. Missioned to lead man in the ignorance towards the light of the divine consciousness, it takes the essence of all experience in the ignorance to form a nucleus of soul growth in the nature. The rest it turns into material for the future growth of the instruments, which it has to use until they are ready to be a luminous instrumentation of the divine. So some gets used right away, and some, in a sense, is postponed for future digestion. It is this secret psychic entity, which is the true original conscience in us, deeper than the constructed and conventional conscience of the moralist. For it is this which points always towards truth and right and beauty, towards love and harmony, and all that is a divine possibility in us, and persists till these things become the major need of our nature. So in other words, he's gone back to the original French meaning, or the French usage of this term, conscience. Conscience, I suppose, something like that, which means consciousness. So it's not the moral sense, you know, what is right, what is wrong, but this is the core consciousness in us, which tends towards these great truths and presses and presses until we begin to become receptive, even in our outer nature, to the direction that this indweller throws upon us. That, yes, we want to grow, we want to move and respond to the call of the infinite. It is the psychic personality in us that flowers as the saint, the sage, the seer. When it reaches its full strength, it turns the being towards the knowledge of self and the divine, towards the supreme truth, the supreme good, the supreme beauty, love, and bliss, the divine heights and largenesses, and opens us to the touch of spiritual sympathy, universality, oneness. This, again, is that psychic personality that he's distinguished from the sheer psychic essence, the entity within, and that temporary arrangement which we call our frontal personality. So the psychic's transformative input upon our natural being is described here. It has an influence. It's not identical to our frontal nature, but it influences it as a hand reaches into a glove and can begin to take command of the glove, the more and more it can extend itself into it. So the entity uses the psychic personality to interface with nature and marry all of this together, to synthesize, to combine, to felicitate. So in this way, we are arcing towards the spiritual, towards the vastness of sympathy, towards oneness. On the contrary, where the psychic personality is weak, crude, or ill-developed, the finer parts and movements in us are lacking or poor in character and power, even though the mind may be forceful and brilliant, the heart of vital emotions hard and strong and masterful, the life force dominant and successful, the bodily existence rich and fortunate and an apparent lord and victor. It is then the outer desire soul, the pseudo-psychic entity that reigns, and we mistake its misinterpretations of psychic suggestion and aspiration, its ideas and ideals, its desires and yearnings for true soul stuff and wealth of spiritual experience. So he writes that with a gentle mockery. These seem to be successes, not so great. Let's read footnote 7. The word psychic in our ordinary parlance is more often used in reference to this desire soul than to the true psychic. It is used still more loosely of psychological and other phenomena of an abnormal or supernormal character, which are really connected with the inner mind, inner vital, subtle physical being, subliminal in us, and are not at all direct operations of the psyche. Even such phenomena as materialization and dematerialization are included, though, if established, they evidently are not soul action and would not shed any light upon the nature or existence of the psychic entity, but would rather be an abnormal action of an occult, subtle physical energy intervening in the ordinary status of the gross body of things, reducing it to its own subtle condition, and again reconstituting it in the terms of gross matter. So all the phenomena, you might say, of the astral worlds, where you bring an object into existence or make it disappear from existence, all of this may be covered by, in Western parlance, psychic phenomena, but have no relationship to the powers of the true soul within. That is the psyche, and not this subtle nature, what we would call the subliminal nature, in which these phenomena are arranged and occur. So, a distinction that we must always bear with us. What Sri Aurobindo means by the psychic, the psyche, is quite different from what we read in popular books. And now to the last sentence of this paragraph. If the secret psychic person can come forward into the front and, replacing the desire soul, govern overtly and entirely, and not only partially and from behind the veil, this outer nature of mind, life, and body, then these can be cast into soul images of what is true, right, and beautiful. And in the end, the whole nature can be turned towards the real aim of life, the supreme victory, the ascent into spiritual existence. We'll pause there and turn directly to Savitri. Continuing in the passage that we started last week, to sound poetic assonance to what he has just written philosophically. Out of the dim recesses of the self, the occult seeker into the open came. He heard the far and touched the intangible. He gazed into the future and the unseen. He used the powers earth instruments cannot use, a pastime made of the impossible. He caught up fragments of the omniscient's thought. He scattered formulas of omnipotence. Thus man in his little house made of earth's dust grew towards an unseen heaven of thought and dream, looking into the vast vistas of his mind on a small globe dotting infinity. At last, climbing a long and narrow stair, he stood alone on the high roof of things and saw the light of a spiritual sun. Aspiring, he transcends his earthly self. He stands in the largeness of his soul, newborn, redeemed from encirclement by mortal things, and moves in a pure, free spiritual realm, as in the rare breath of a stratosphere. A last end of far lines of divinity, he mounts by a frail thread to his high source. He reaches his fount of immortality. He calls the Godhead into his mortal life. All this the spirit concealed had done in her. A portion of the mighty mother came into her as into its own human part. Amid the cosmic workings of the gods, it marked her the center of a wide-drawn scheme, dreamed in the passion of her far-seeing spirit to mold humanity into God's own shape and lead this great, blind, struggling world to light, or a new world discover or create. Earth must transform herself and equal heaven, or heaven descend into earth's mortal state. But for such vast spiritual change to be, out of the mystic cavern in man's heart, the heavenly psyche must put off her veil and step into common nature's crowded rooms and stand uncovered in that nature's front and rule its thoughts and fill the body and life. Obedient to a high command she sat. Time, life, and death were passing incidents, obstructing with their transient view her sight. Her sight that must break through and liberate the God imprisoned in the visionless mortal man. The inferior nature born into ignorance still took too large a place. It veiled herself and must be pushed aside to find her soul. This is the end of Canto 2. In Book 7, the Book of Yoga, this, the parable of the search for the soul. So next week, we complete this wonderful 23rd chapter in the Life Divine, the double soul in man. Felicitous meditations to you. Felicitous actions all consecrated to the divine. Namaste. Jai Ma.